All right. So picking back up, chapter 3. So what you have, right, Israel is all set to enter the land. They're ready to go, but they have kind of one last obstacle in the way, and that is what? The Jordan River. Okay, so if you remember, they're on the east side of the Jordan River. They need to get to the west, right? That's where the main land of Canaan is. And so as the text mentions in chapter 3, verse 15, it's springtime during this time, and so that's when you have kind of like snow melts and stuff like that, and so the Jordan River actually kind of overflows and everything, so it's not as if like this is like a little stream that they just kind of like, oh, step over, don't get wet, right? Like kind of a thing, and just like, all right, we're in, right? It's almost like impassable in a sense, right? And so what we're going to see, though, is what? The Lord intervenes. The Lord will intervene. And so the Lord instructs that the priests carry the Ark of the Covenant and go stand in the Jordan. And as soon as their feet touch the water, what, the water of the Jordan, it says, will be cut off from flowing and instead will stand in kind of like one big heap downstream or upstream, actually, at a location called Adam. And so the Jordan River flows from north to south, from like the Sea of Galilee down into the Dead Sea. So it flows down that way. And so God is going to intervene to essentially stop that flow upstream and kind of pile up the waters, okay? And so let's point out a couple more things here. So first, notice kind of the emphasis on the Ark of the Covenant here. And what was the Ark supposed to represent? Yeah, the presence of God, right? The presence of God. And so the fact that the priests, it's when the priests carrying the Ark, and it's only when the Ark comes like to the Jordan that all these miraculous things happen, right? It's not coincidental. It's not accidental. This is a clear message to Israel that your God is at work, okay? It wasn't just like, oh, that's a nice coincidence. The Jordan just stopped flowing, right? So God is clearly at work. Second, okay, you have the waters kind of being stood up in one heap, and it says like, and the people crossed on dry ground. What's that kind of make you think of? Yeah, the Red Sea and the Exodus, all right? And that's not accidental, right? That connection is not accidental. What is God communicating? It's what? That the same God who worked in the Exodus and brought the people out is the same God that is now at work in the conquest. That just as he was with them in the past, he is with them in the present. That's what he is communicating with this. And Joshua even picks that up in chapter 3, verse 10. And he says, like, this is a confirmation that the Lord will, in fact, do what he has said. Okay? That God is working here. He will be faithful. So, again, this gives encouragement to the people, right? That the same God of the Exodus is the same God at work here in the conquest. Third, this is not only a sign for Israel, but who else do you think this is kind of a sign to? Huh?
The Canaanites.
Yeah. Yeah, the Canaanites, right? Because remember from our account of Rahab, word was clearly spreading. They have some eyes on the situation and all that, and maybe some of them are thinking, is this all really true, right? Is this Yahweh we're hearing about able to actually do all that we've heard about? And what happens? Like, the Jordan happens, like, oh, okay. It's like, yes, he is able to do all that he has said, and what, he's coming for you, right? Like, it's kind of like, uh-oh. We no longer have this kind of barrier between us, okay? So the people cross, and they build kind of this memorial to be able to point to the Lord's faithfulness in future generations and all that. But then, I should know one other thing. So what happens as soon as the people all pass and the ark is brought up out of the Jordan? What happens? Yeah, the water flows again, right? All that. And so why is that significant? There's kind of no going back, right? You're kind of stuck. It's like, here we go. You're all in, okay? Because it's not like, this is hard. Let's turn back and go the other way. It's what? You're pinned to the Jordan now, right? Like, you're kind of stuck. And so we see that they are now in the land, only moving forward, right? Only moving forward here. But they're finally in the promised land, right? They're finally there, finally in the land, okay? And as they enter the land, it's kind of interesting of like, okay, well, what's kind of their first move going to be? What's kind of the idea? What are they going to do? And maybe the people that are watching are kind of wondering what's their first move. And what do they first do? Like chapter 5, what do they do? After they set up camp? Yeah, they circumcise all the males. So you have the new generation circumcised. Okay, so maybe not the best military strategy you would think of, right? Of, all right, now that we're in the land, let's circumcise all of the males. Because if you remember, we had a situation kind of like this back in Genesis. Do you remember another time when a lot of people were circumcised? Yeah, like the guy Shechem and all that, and with Jacob's sons, and they all got circumcised, and while they're kind of sore and recovering, you had Simeon and Levi come in and kind of wipe them all out, okay? And so here, they cross the Jordan, get in the land, and then, all right, circumcised. And you think, well, wouldn't it have been better on like the other side, right? Like you kind of have a little barrier or something like that. But again, remember, what is the key to Israel's success in the conquest? Obedience. It's God, right? And so they listen to what God, even if you might be thinking like, this doesn't seem like a good idea. But they do it, right? They obey and they trust the Lord, okay? And so they obey, all the males are circumcised. And what, God like protects them and everything, right? Nothing happens to them. And so again, element of trusting God, obeying him, even when they're potentially sitting ducks, right? Kind of right there. All right. And so then after that, now that they have gone through like the circumcision, all that, they then also celebrate Passover in the land. Okay, they celebrate Passover in the land. And so this would suggest that we are pretty much like 40 years to the day from the time of the Exodus, right? Because you remember the Exodus, what, Passover is that night, right? As they're going, as they're leaving. And so now 40 years later, essentially to that day, they're in the land, okay? But this is more significant than just timing of like, oh, that's nice, 40 years, that's awesome. But what? Because do you remember what like the Passover celebrated? It celebrated God's deliverance and redemption of his people from Egypt. That was the point. And so the fact that they're doing this again as they enter the land declares that what God started, namely this deliverance from Egypt, he will be faithful to finish, essentially settling in the promised land, okay? He started with the Exodus. He's going to finish it with a conquest here. They're going to get into the land, and that's what this Passover is celebrating, okay? And then notice that the day after the Passover, they were able to eat from the produce of the land. And then the following day, all the manna ceased. All right, the manna ceased. So again, that signals the wilderness wanderings are over. Now the conquest is about to begin. Okay, it's about to begin. All right, so that takes us into our second kind of main section here of the actual conquest. So conquering the land. And so it's now officially beginning. But before kind of getting into the actual conquest, should make a note on kind of like the path of the conquest or what's kind of the strategy here a little bit. And so you can see that it's kind of divided into three campaigns. Okay, the conquest is divided into three campaigns. It starts in the middle. There's a middle campaign. Then they go south, so the southern campaign, and then north for the northern campaign. Okay, and so I've heard it described before in kind of a memorable way. It's almost like you punch them in the gut, then kick them in the kneecap or shins, and then finish them off with the uppercut, right? So kind of, I don't know, take that for what it's worth, but it sticks in your mind. So middle, south, north, all that, okay? And besides that, right, you have some strategy of that, right? They start the middle, it kind of divides the land kind of in half, right? So divides some of the forces in half. And then they go south because they're a little closer to the south. And then all that's left is the north. So that's kind of the order of the conquest. And what we're going to see that as we go through these different campaigns, each campaign is going to, again, kind of reveal something about God. Okay, it's going to reveal something about God for us. And so we'll kind of point those things out as we approach each campaign. And so to start off, where do they start again?
Middle,
all right? Punch of the gut, right? So start in the middle. And the theme of that, so it's like the central campaign, and a fitting theme is that God is central. All right, God is central. That's really what we're going to see on display. He needs to be central to all things. So he is central. And so we'll unpack that as we go through. So what you have here, so before we get into the conquest of like Jericho and all that, you have this interesting interaction between Joshua and this individual referred to as the commander of the army of the Lord. And so this is very likely like a pre-incarnate Christ. Okay, this is very likely a pre-incarnate Christ here. And so, well, how do we know? Well, a couple things kind of point us to this, that this is not just a normal human and probably not like just an angel. Because notice like in verse 14, when Joshua like interacts with him, what does he do? Fell on his face and does what? Worshipped him. Okay? If you've seen that throughout scripture, when people try to do this with angels, what do they normally do? Stop them, right? They're like, hey, like, I'm not the one you're worshiping, right? Like, I stop them. And so, and again, this wouldn't be any person either, right? Like, they're the only one deserving of worship is God, okay? This is not just a man or angel, it's God, right? And so it makes sense. But then also in verse 15, this individual commands Joshua to do what? Yeah. Take off your sandals from your feet, for the place where you're standing is holy ground. What does that make you think of?
God's presence.
Okay, God's presence. Yeah, Moses in the burning bush, right? Like back in Exodus, Moses in the burning bush says the same thing, right? Like, hey, take off your sandals, you're on holy ground. And so it's probably the same person that was in the burning bush as it is in here, okay? And so I'd argue that is that pre-incarnate Christ, okay? And so why is this important besides being like a cool connection? Like, oh, that's cool. Jesus is there, right? Well, do you remember, right, when we're talking about like conquest theology, like who is the one who's going to finish the conquest?
Jesus.
And so what you have here is that the one who finishes the conquest is appearing to the one who starts it. And it shows that Jesus is essentially the one who has been driving the conquest from beginning to end, right? He is the one driving it from beginning to end, okay, is what you have on display here. All right, so let's get into the actual conquest then. So chapter 6, we see the conquering of Jericho. And so first stop on this middle campaign is Jericho. And again, this account may be familiar to some of you, at least maybe like you've seen the VeggieTale version or something and all that. And so again, we'll point out some things, make some connections. So how many days do they march around the city? Do you guys remember? 7. Have you ever thought why? Why 7 days? Where have we seen 7 days before?
Creation.
Creation. And so this isn't an accident, right? Like if they want to make a connection to something else, you get to make a connection to like the resurrection or something and march like 3 days or something like that. But it seems to be the 7 days is to purposely connect back to creation, that they are proclaiming about like their God, that he is the creator. Okay, they have the creator on their side. Okay, that's really what this emphasis is. Because it's not just like, oh, a week is just a nice number. Let's just do it, right? It's no, there's a purpose to this. And then do you remember that as they march around like these 7 days and do all that, what were they supposed to do?
Blow their horns.
Yeah, who was? Do you remember? Was everyone? Yeah, the priest, right? So not everyone. What was everyone else supposed to do?
Stop screaming.
On the last day they were, but the first six, sorry, I should clarify. I should clarify my question. So on the first 6 days, what were they supposed to do? March around, and what else were they supposed to do?
Carry the tabernacle.
Yeah, the Ark of the Covenant, yeah.
Sorry, not tabernacle.
Yeah, that's all good. So Ark of the Covenant, and what else? Were they supposed to like make any noise? Yeah, so most of the people were supposed to be silent, okay, except for actually the priests who were going before the Ark of the Covenant. So if you look at verse 8, notice there, like, so just as Joshua commanded the people, the 7 priests bearing the 7 trumpets of ram's horns before the Lord went forward, blowing the trumpets with the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord following them. Okay, so they were continually blowing. And so what you have, especially on these like 6 days, is you have all the people kind of marching around the city, probably not like at the walls, right? Because that's how you get killed, right? So they're kind of away from it, but they're marching around. And so this whole group of people are completely silent except for these priests blowing these trumpets that are leading the Ark of the Covenant. So you have kind of the Ark of the Covenant in the middle. So you have people going before them, people after, and in the middle you have this Ark of the Covenant, trumpets blowing. And so if you were the people of Jericho, where would your attention be focused? The Ark, right? All the noise, right? You'd be drawn to the noise of there's all these people silent, but there's one thing making noise, and you'd be drawn to that, and specifically the Ark of the Covenant. And again, what is this proclaiming? That who is this campaign ultimately about? God. It's about Him. Okay? And the one who fights and wins is God. He is the God of the 7 days. He is the creator. It is all about Him. Okay? Remember our theme of this campaign. God is central. And that's what you see Israel putting on display here. Okay? It is all about Him. And so they do this for those 6 days, and then on the 7th day, they do things a little differently, right? They march around 7 times instead of just the once. But then when the priests make like the long blow of the horn, what do all the people do?
Shout.
And what happens? The walls fall down. Okay, the walls fall down. Huh? Yeah, So the walls fall down, and now... Okay, what's kind of interesting about these walls falling down, besides like falling down from shouting, because that doesn't normally happen, right? So how does the text describe how these walls fell? Outward. Yeah, so they actually, yeah, fall outward. So the ESV, like mine says, they fell flat, but more literally, kind of it says that the walls fell underneath itself, right? They fell underneath themselves. And kind of the archaeology supports that the walls actually fell outward, okay? And why would that be kind of not normal? Yeah. Yeah, and if you were a person attacking, would you want the walls to fall outward? Probably not, right? Because no one goes to siege a city and like, yeah, pull it down, right? Like, because what's going to happen? You're just going to get crushed, right? It's not going to end well for you. And so normally what happens, what? As you siege and you break through a wall, it falls inward, not outward. And so, again, who is at work here? God, right? It's showing He is at work because, again, Israel wouldn't pull them outward. Jericho's not pushing their walls down, right? Like, it's the work of God here. And really what ends up happening, what people kind of argue is as it, when it talks about it like falling under itself, is it probably fell to where it essentially almost creates a ramp into the city, right? So the upper wall kind of falls and creates a ramp that Israel's like, all right, let's just go right in, right? And they go right into the city, right? So it creates this ramp. They can easily get access into the city, okay? Which, again, seems to do justice to the text of saying that it fell underneath itself, okay? So once again, God is on display, though. This is not, again, through their might, through their strategy, right? If their strategy is let's go shout at the walls, not going to end well for them, right? Like, but this is God working. This is God on display here, okay? But then we also can't miss something significant in this passage. Verse 17 mentions that Jericho was to be devoted to the Lord for destruction, okay? And some translations might say something like put under the ban or something like that, or maybe you've heard that kind of idea. And the idea is that this city was to be wholly set apart and consecrated for God. Essentially, all for Him, none for you, right? It was all for Him. So everything was to be devoted for destruction, except I think like some of the gold, silver, all that was then put in the treasury of the Lord, all that. But everything was for Him, okay? And so, again, this kind of ties back into, if you remember like when we talked in Leviticus, the different types of offerings, there's the burnt offering. That was to show that you were wholly consecrated to the Lord. And you remember what kind of symbolized that and like to show that total devotion. What'd you do with that sacrifice? It was what? It was fully burnt up, right? It was fully burnt up, consumed like by the fires, right? All of it to show I'm fully committed, consecrating myself to the Lord, right? That's kind of that idea. And so you have kind of this similar picture, this idea of this being totally devoted to the Lord means what? It's a complete destruction, right? You're not holding back anything for yourself. It's all to be consecrated to the Lord, okay? Keep that in mind. All right, so the people go, they conquer Jericho, sparing only Rahab and her family, so keeping that promise, all that. And then notice at the end of the chapter, Joshua pronounces a curse on the one who would ever rebuild Jericho, okay? That it would cost the life of his firstborn son and then the life of his youngest son as well, okay? And so just keep that little nugget in the back of your mind because that'll come up later in the Old Testament where, spoiler alert, someone tries to rebuild Jericho, right? So that's what they do, right? It doesn't end well, okay? And again, shows kind of the wickedness of that time when they do that. All right, so the conquering of Jericho kind of seems to be overall good. People have seemed to obey the Lord, all that. But let's see if that continues. In chapter 7, verse 1, we get clarity, what? That did they fully obey this? No. We have this guy come on the scene, Achan, who it says broke the faith and took some of like the devoted things for himself. Okay, and we just have this glimpse where it references that, and it says the anger of the Lord burned against the people of Israel in verse 1. And, okay, we'll see how that plays out for them then as they now go to this next city, okay? So this is where we have I or AI or however you pronounce it. We'll go with I. Yeah, not artificial intelligence, just, yeah, so I. And so, again, maybe something you've heard before, right, where they send the spies up to Ai, check it out. The spies come back. Hey, it's like a small place. Like, we don't need to send everyone up there. It's fine. So they decide they'll just send like a few thousand, about 3,000 people up to go conquer them. And do you remember what happens? Right. Yeah, they do not succeed, right? They end up fleeing before the men of Ai. And actually end up, 36 of their people end up dying, all right? 36 Israelites end up dying in the process, okay? And then notice kind of like the reaction of Joshua and stuff where what? He reacts where it's like he falls to the ground, tears his clothes, all this, like, Lord, how could you like do this, all this stuff, right? And you can kind of think like, this seems kind of extreme, right? Like, do you think like in the grand scheme of wars, like, yes, like, any loss of life is tragic, right? But like 36, like that doesn't seem like that bad, right? Like it's like maybe 1% of their 3,000, right? Close to that. You're like, that doesn't seem too bad. But what you have to understand is that, like some scholars suggest, is that this is really the first time actually anyone has died in battle for them. Okay? That they all along have been just kind of almost like, yep, here's my chore. I'm going to go do this real quick. Let me go fight this battle. And like everyone goes, everyone comes back. Because what? They understood God is on our side. Like we're not going to get defeated. We can't die. Like God's with us. And so then now all of a sudden, what? People died. And that completely rattles them. Like what just happened? Like I thought God is with us. What happened? And that explains kind of the reason for this reaction. But then we see the Lord responds to Joshua here. He kind of says like, hey, get up, right? And he explains that, what? There's been sin, right? There is sin. There's a reason for this. It isn't as if God just kind of abandoned them all of a sudden, but rather there was a reason. And again, this ties into what we said before. It'll be through what that they will succeed or fail? Obedience, right? And when they don't obey, they will fail. God needs to be central, right? That's what we're seeing. And so, in order to kind of rectify this, they need to deal with the sin that's in the camp if they want the Lord to be with them. And so that's exactly what they do. The next day, they kind of cast the lots and all that to narrow down. They start with like, oh, let's gather all the tribes, cast the lots, what tribe is it from? Then like the families, all that. All the way down until they narrow it. It is Achan. And Joshua tells him to what? Give glory to God and tell me what you've done, right? Again, all about God's glory here. And so Achan confesses what he's done. He's taken some of the devoted things. And the result is what? There's judgment that needs to be rendered, okay? And so the text talks about that as that he and all he has will be burned and stoned, and it's kind of the correlation, right? Like, you took what belonged to God, everything will be taken from you, right? And that's kind of the punishment fits the crime in a sense, right? And so that's what's going on here. So they deal with this. They deal with the sin. Achan is put to death, all that. And so now with the sin dealt with, they try again to attack Ai in chapter 8. And were they successful this time? Yes. Why? Yeah, because God is with them, right? Because God is on their side. And then just like Jericho, they completely devote it to destruction, burn it down, all that, okay? And it seems they learn their lesson this time. They actually do it and all that. But notice real quick, verse 28 of chapter 8, it says, "So Joshua burned Ai and made it forever a heap of ruins as it is to this day." And it's interesting because the name Ai actually means ruins or place of desolation, right? It's kind of like what that little name Ai means. And if you remember, I kind of briefly made the comment in our introduction when we're talking about like the burn layers and all that with like Jericho and Hazor. But I made that comment of like, we don't know about the burn layers of that because we haven't been able to locate it yet. Okay? We don't know exactly where the city of Ai is. And isn't that actually like kind of cool though, that the place that he says like, oh, it's going to be like this heap of ruins forever, we can't even find it, right? We don't know where it is. And so that's kind of an interesting kind of tidbit there, right? So maybe one day someone will find it, but it'll still be ruins. But yeah, but it's kind of an interesting fact with that. So just want to point that out there. All right, and so chapter 8 then ends, though, so after this whole thing with Ai, with what we call like a covenant renewal, all right? Covenant renewal, where they kind of renew this covenant with the Lord, and this was actually to kind of fulfill some instruction that Moses gave in Deuteronomy 27 that talked about like, hey, once you enter the land, you need to kind of do this, right? You go to this Mount Ebal, build altar, sacrifice, kind of, review the law, all this stuff. And that's what they do. Okay, so they go to this Mount Ebal, offer these sacrifices. Joshua writes a copy of the law in the presence of the people. And you have like half the people in front of, it says Mount Ebal, half in front of Gerizim. And then he reads the law to all of them, right, in all their hearing. So again, they're kind of renewing this, agreeing to it again, right? Like that, yes, this is the covenant, the relationship that we have with God. He is our God. We are his people. We're renewing that fact. But another significant part of this is that if they are kind of in between those two mountains, that's where like the city of Shechem is. Okay, that's where the city of Shechem is. And the significance of that is we've seen Shechem before. Not just the guy that was like circumcised and killed or whatever. That guy was also named Shechem. But the city, Shechem, that's actually in Genesis 12, is where the Lord appeared to Abram and promised Abram that his offspring would own this land. All right, that is where the Lord declared to Abram, like, this is your land, and I will give this land to your offspring. And so now Joshua and the Israelites are at the place, that same place, about 600 years later, where God promised this to Abram. And so can you imagine the impact that that would have on the people? Of like, hey, you're in the spot, you're in the place that God promised your forefather, the patriarch Abraham, that he would give this land to his offspring, and you are now here in that land. Okay? And so God has brought you all the way back home to be faithful to what he's promised. And since God has been faithful, what do they need to be? Faithful. Right? That's why they renew the covenant at this time, right? God has been faithful. They need to be faithful also. Okay? All right. And then that takes us into the Southern Campaign. All right? The Southern Campaign. So kind of the kick in the knee captions, all that. And I think so. We've got middle, south, and kind of when the emphasis here in the Southern campaign is to show like the intensity of God's power, to show the intensity of God's power, that he has immense power, okay, is really kind of the theme or goal of the Southern campaign, okay? And so as we come into chapter 9, this is the story of the Gibeonites, who, when they hear of all that Israel has done, they have like a little different tactic than most of the other people. When the other people hear, they are like afraid, but then they figure out some way to try to attack Israel. But instead, the Gibeonites, they decide to try to make a peace treaty with Israel. But if you remember, like, do you think Israel is just going to agree to, like, if they come and say, like, hey, let's just be at peace? Do you think Israel would agree to that? No, right? Like, they're like, no, we got to conquer the land, right? That's what we're doing. And so they develop this strategy where, if you remember, they kind of pretend like they're from some far-off land and stuff, and kind of get their clothes all dirty, all this other stuff, and pretend like, yeah, we're from some faraway place, but we've heard of you, and we want to make this treaty with you, with your God and all that, and essentially trying to deceive them into making a treaty with them. And do you remember, does that succeed? Do they actually make the treaty?
Yeah.
They do, right? They do make the treaty. And it's really a failure of Israel, right? And verse 14 of chapter 9 explains why. It says, so the men took some of the provisions, but what? They did not ask counsel from the Lord. They did not ask the Lord of what they ought to do. And so they got deceived. They got fooled. And so they made this treaty with these people of Gibeon. Okay? And that ties into even that previous theme of, like, God needs to be central, right? Like, he should have been consulted, right? Like, about all this. But they did not. And they were deceived. And the importance of this is the city of Gibeon actually sits in a very strategic location in Israel. It's something called like the Central Benjamin Plateau. But essentially what that is, right, it's like a central hub to a lot of routes that go through Israel. And so if you really want to control like the routes and the travel through Israel, that's like an important place to have. And yet, what? They now haven't conquered it necessarily. Like, yeah, like the Gibeonites will kind of serve them, all that. But they didn't really conquer it. It's not truly theirs, okay? And so a big kind of failure on their part, right? And so you're seeing that glimpse of already, are they going to be able to complete the conquest? No, right? They're already starting to fail this, okay? But then once the other kings kind of around that area, once they hear this treaty between Israel and Gibeon, they're like, hey, we got to deal with this. So they form this coalition to attack. So these five kings kind of develop, get their troops, and they go after Gibeon. They're like, let's just knock them off first, all that. And so Gibeon, they appeal to Israel to come help them. And do you remember, does Israel help them? Yeah, they do. They don't leave them high and dry. They help them. And this is where, actually to help them, Joshua and his troops, they hike overnight to get there, all right? So they try to get there as fast as possible to help them. They hike overnight, and they were camped at like Gilgal at this time, and this Gibeon. Really, this is like an 18-mile or so kind of trek, all uphill, okay? Not ideal, and you know, the ascent, right, over that time is probably about like 3,500 feet. So, I don't know, if you're thinking of a recipe for like, okay, how should I best prepare my troops for battle? Do you think pulling an all-nighter would be good first off? No. And then probably doing like an 18-mile hike all uphill, would that be good either? No, right? And so once again, all this is going to put on display. Who's ultimately the one working here? God, right? Because what happens as they get there? It catches all the coalition off guard and everything. And so the Lord puts them in a panic, and the people start fleeing from Israel, all that, right? And so they're having the success. And again, that's all God, right? It's not just, again, these people are all strong and in their own might. But again, you have all these people that just hiked many miles, are probably tired, haven't slept, right? That's not recipe for a good warrior there. But God is at work, okay? And so the armies flee from Israel, and Israel pursues after them. And then this is kind of the cool story. Do you guys remember what God does during this? By chance?
He steals the sun and the moon?
Yeah, he does do that eventually. Before that, he does confuse them. He does something else.
Wait, stones them? The hailstones?
Yeah, he rains down hailstones on them, all right? And killing a bunch of the Amorites, right? Through the hurling these hailstones down from heaven. And it says that that more people actually died from the hailstones than from the sword of Israel, right? Like, so really, you almost have that picture of like Israel is trying to like wipe out people and they're just dropping from hailstones. Like, oh, I thought I had him. Okay, like move on to the next guy. And if you stop and think about this, like, how amazing is this, right? Because if you think of battles, especially then, right? Like, there's just all these people running around. They're all intermixing. There's Israelites, there's the Amorites all kind of mingling about, like fighting, all that. And only the Amorites are getting hit by these hailstones, right? It's not like collateral damage of like God's like, oh, I actually got an Israelite, right? Like, sorry. But no, he's raining down on all these Amorites. And just thinking about just God's, again, the immense power here to be able to pull this off, because what? Something falling from the sky to the ground, that's a long distance, right? So you have to know, oh, this person's going to be at the exact place at this exact time, and it's going to nail him, right? And it's like he's just like sniping out people, right? Like it's essentially what's happening, and with expert precision, and it's just amazing, right? It's amazing. Huh?
In the desert.
Yeah, like in like a desert and stuff. Yeah, like he's just going, so. Yeah. So, yeah, and some of the hill country, all that, right? He's just sniping them out. And so, again, God's immense power is on display. And then that you also have the end of this passage, as was mentioned, the sun and moon standing still, like Joshua prays, asks the Lord that, like, kind of extend the day, extend the battle, all this, and the Lord does it, again, showing his power, okay? And then the chapter, the account kind of ends with the execution of the five kings of this coalition. And just, we don't really have time to unpack this all here, but like, notice how they are put to death. They're hung on a what? A tree. They're hung on a tree. This is the execution for the kings. All right? Which starts to foreshadow what other king's death? Jesus, right? Christ. He was also hung on a tree. Okay? And just, yeah. Little nugget, keep that in your mind. All right. And then the chapter kind of wraps up with conquering the rest of the southern kingdom, or the southern Canaan, not kingdom. All right. Let's see. We might be out of time. Let's see. Let's finish the conquest real quick. Okay. So then you have the north, right? The northern campaign. And we'll wrap this up real quick. And what we see here, kind of the main point, is the breadth of God's power, the breadth of God's power. So we saw the intensity of it, the immense power, but also the breadth of it. Essentially, no matter what is thrown at God, his power will win. Okay, whatever's thrown at God, his power will win. And so once again, same with the north, you have this idea of like a coalition being formed. All these kings kind of gather to try to defeat Israel. But notice this time in verse 4, not only were the number of their troops great, but also what did they have? A great number of, yeah, horses and chariots. So they were more technologically advanced than Israel and all that. And yet, this is still no match for God's power, right? It just simply talks about how he delivers them over to Joshua and the Israelites all defeat them. They destroy them. But then notice in verse 9, of chapter 11 there. What does Joshua do with like the horses and chariots and stuff?
Does Hod mean killed?
Huh?
It says Hod. Does that mean killed? H-O-U-G-H?
Yeah. I think mine says like hamstrung. So normally what that'd be like is cutting a tendon or something to make it like not able to gallop very much. So they can't use it for military anymore or like only for like farming or stuff like that. So he does that. They burn the chariots. Why would they do that? Again, connection back to the Torah, Deuteronomy. Why would they do that? Why wouldn't they like, hey, these are some useful things. Let's keep these. Yeah, yeah. Back in Deuteronomy 17, that was specifically for the kings, but in general, right, they were not supposed to multiply three things. And we talked about like our three G's, okay, which were, they weren't supposed to, the kings weren't supposed to multiply gals, so multiple wives, all that. They weren't supposed to multiply gold, so get all that. And then they weren't supposed to multiply Gideon. All right? Which is like horses. Okay? Because all of those were temptations to not trust the Lord, right? Because it's, oh, if we have all our military might and our strength, then what? The temptation is we're good. We don't need God. We got all the new high-tech chariot going and all that. But they get rid of the horses. They destroy all the chariots, right? Like they get away all that. To be faithful to this, right? So Joshua is listening to that and obeying that. Okay? And so then they go through and conquer the rest of the northern land. And this is where you see the city of Hazor is also burned and devoted to destruction, just like Jericho and Ai. But the rest of the cities did not burn. It says they do not burn them. Again, supporting what we said before about in our introduction to the conquest. Okay? And then chapter 11 just ends with kind of a summary of the conquest, of what they've kind of accomplished here and all that. And then chapter 12 is just a list of the various kings that were defeated when they were beyond the Jordan, and then as well as in the land itself as well. Okay? All right. So we'll just stop there, and then we'll pick up